It's the 16th of November 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Can the National Health Action Party stop the NHS's bleeding before it's too late? If you want to crowdfund basic scientific research, is researching the effects of drugs a lucrative place to start? Do the kids care about freedom of expression online? And will the supply of crazy Americans reacting to the election ever run out? But first, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion, please do subscribe and donate and support what we do. All we ask is for £5 or £10 a month from all of our listeners to help us pay costs associated with the podcast. In the last 2 months, our hosting costs have actually doubled, weirdly enough, so all donations are really appreciated. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. But now we start the show this week with the latest salvo in the ongoing battle between freedom of tweets and the old farts who make the rules, not really understanding the internet, and yet trying to tell us what to do anyway. Matt Flaherty this week has been taking issue with the Director of Public Prosecutions, who you may remember from such hits as the Twitter joke trial, over new Twitter prosecution guidelines, which are all predicated on your follower count. I have a dream that our fellow members of the Twitterati will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the number of their followers, but by the contents of their 140 characters. Here's Matt Flaherty with more.
I've never been a fan of the current Director of Public Prosecutions, but something I read Tuesday had me shaking with rage. This is no exaggeration. Keir Starmer QC thinks that a person's Twitter follower count should determine whether or not to prosecute someone for a grossly offensive tweet. On Monday, he told the ISP Association conference that his eagerly anticipated guidelines for prosecutors dealing with online speech offenses will likely include looking at a speaker's reach. Someone who tweets or posts on a Facebook wall to thousands something deemed to be grossly offensive will likely face prosecution, whereas someone with only a few dozen followers might go unpunished. This approach betrays serious misunderstandings at a basic level. You don't tweet to thousands of people, you tweet, and thousands of people have chosen to have your tweet delivered to them. If some of these people don't like what they see, they are free to let the tweeter know in the strongest terms. They are free to stop receiving delivery of that person's tweets. They are free to block the person and report them to Twitter for violation of its usage policy. There is an array of extra legal remedies available. The same is true of Facebook and other similar forums. This is not a spam mass mailing or a multiple simultaneous crank phone call. He still doesn't get it. Graham Linehan clearly wasn't pleased when he discovered that he apparently has less of a right to speak than Mavis Chundertwund of East Grinstead, West Sussex. I'm floored to learn that the prosecution of Daniel Thomas was dropped for no other reason than that he had about 100 followers. Daniel Thomas sent a tweet that was judged to be homophobic and involved two members of Britain's Olympic diving team, naming them without addressing them. After the pair failed to win a medal in their event, he wrote, quote, "If there is any consolation for finishing fourth, at least Daly and Waterfield can go and bum each other with hashtag Team HIV," end quote. What struck me when I first read this is how very far from anything like grossly offensive this text is. It is barely even offensive when you take the time to think about what he has done. Team HIV sort of rhymes with Team GB, and that may have been what gave him the idea. It is a crude, juvenile, and poorly executed joke. Still, someone reported him to the police, and he was arrested. He was very nearly charged with the offense of sending a grossly offensive message by way of a public electronic communications network, contrary to the infamous Section 127 of the Communications Act 2003. The only reason he was not is that very few people would have seen it. Actually, many thousands more people have now seen it as a result of this boneheaded case and the media attention it received. What makes for grossly offensive? Keir Starmer believes that the size of any negative reaction online should also be a factor. Maybe a few people complained about Daniel Thomas's remarks. I wonder how many complained about the incident on Sunday that saw a young man arrested and held for nearly 24 hours by Kent police following the posting to his own Facebook wall of a picture of a poppy pin being burned with a cigarette lighter and the caption, "How about that, you squatty C-words?" Squatty was misspelt. Sadly, the C-word was not. Sunday was Remembrance Day. An unthinking local parish councillor told the Sun, "It's absolutely disgusting and disgraceful what this lad did. He should be severely punished. I've got 5 sons either serving or have served in Afghanistan and Iraq. I know what they'd like to do to this idiot." What would your sons like to do to this idiot? Maybe fill him with lead like that U.S. soldier did to the 16 innocent civilians, including women and children, he killed in a homicidal rampage in Kandahar last March? Or how about the 7 British Marines who have been charged with murdering insurgents? I encountered someone who commented on the Index on Censorship blog saying, "The poppy is our symbol, our reminder of our fallen from over the years. Yes, we have free speech. Yes, we have a free country. But without the hard work of our fallen, past and present, we wouldn't have free speech. I do believe jail would be extreme for this ignorant boy. However, I do not think he should get away with being so obviously disrespectful and ignorant. Without their sacrifices, we would not have free speech. And now, thanks to people like SR0120, name and website address withheld, we don't. Well done. Must we honor soldiers living and dead? Is that not our choice? Do we not also have the choice to dishonor them? Isn't that the freedom worth dying for? The ugly sentiments expressed in the offending Facebook post are as old as war itself. A far-right activist group calling themselves Casuals United has taken credit for creating the furor over the poppy burning act, even bragging and laughing about it on the Twitter feed of one of its members. The same group took credit for having Azhar Ahmed arrested for a Facebook update suggesting that all soldiers should die and go to hell. The thing is, it's very easy to whip up outrage. I can find 100 people on Twitter in a matter of minutes who would be prepared to demonstrate genuine or faux outrage over just about anything. Red tops like the Daily Mail depend on it for their sales. A large part of their business is to create and market outrage. Outrage is cheap. There's value in restraint. If we're going to call it grossly offensive when a sizable chunk of people are offended and outraged, then we might as well hand law enforcement over to the Taliban and subject ourselves to the tyranny of orthodoxy. Burning a poppy in effigy, calling abstract soldiers a nasty name, these are political statements and should be protected. Whether he realizes it or not, what Keir Starmer proposes is mob justice. I'll say it again. This should be written in every public space. No one has the right to not be offended. Everyone has the right to be offended, just as anyone has the right to feel any emotion. However, taking offense does not confer victim status and does not justify behaving unlawfully. Being offended does not make you special. It does not give you powers. The function of the police is not to protect the public from secondhand insults and inflamed sensitivities. Kent police ought to have informed angry callers that the young man was merely expressing an unpopular opinion in an obnoxious manner, which is not a crime. The young man was released on bail and has not been charged by either the police or the CPS, but he still might be. Keir Starmer points out that the Communications Act offense has been on the statute books in one form or another since the 1930s, but the reach and sheer volume of communications over social media has seen it increasingly used to arrest people. He anticipates that without a change, there could be millions of cases going through the system, more than the combined number of every other offense on the statute book. What I take away from that is simple. He believes that people placing objectionable content onto their own Twitter feeds and Facebook walls that they control is equivalent to making nuisance telephone calls or text messages. How strange, then, that the police often fail to pursue cases of abusive and threatening phone calls and text messages. Stephen Farrow of Bridport, Dorset, was a drifter who murdered a pensioner in Worcestershire and a vicar in South Gloucestershire not long after sending some threatening text messages to a friend that had her worried enough to phone the police. In one of these messages, Farrow personally threatened his friend Michaela Rousell, whom he met when she volunteered at a church, for rejecting his affection. On New Year's Eve last year, he sent, "As you reject me, you will suffer. I will be just around the corner, and you will never know when I will be there. You don't and never knew just how disturbed I am. The church will be the first to suffer. It was always going to end like this. You can all go to hell. Watch the news because you will know it was me." Though the message left her terrified, the police reportedly told her that there was nothing they could do. In fact, there was plenty they could have done. Section 127 of the Communications Act was made for this. It is as though a law originally intended for telephony is now thought to be only suitable for internet communications. Was this text not criminal because Farrow had only the one follower, a woman whose only choices were to receive his texts or change her phone number? Starmer worries about the chilling effect that will be experienced if there continues to be a large number of prosecutions for online speech, but he fails to grapple with the cause of the chilling effect. People are doing things that they correctly believe that they have the right to do. They are not anticipating criminal sanctions. The invention of the telephone did not turn good people into nuisances, nor has the invention of social networking technology. We are simply being shown more of someone's thoughts than we get in a meeting in real life. Anyone has the potential to be unpleasant in the right circumstances, and much of what we write in tweets is done unthinkingly. That's the beauty and the power of it. The chilling effect will be experienced when we are forced by law to think a good deal more about what we write on our public timelines. It will be a result of senseless prosecutions, each making it harder to predict what will be deemed unacceptable. Here's the worst part. The accused are often accepting advice to enter a guilty plea, even where the prosecution case turns out to be weak. The advice may be that it will be difficult to secure legal aid when contesting the charge on the basis that the communications were not grossly offensive, and that may be true enough. It may be because a trial is too costly and an early plea will be rewarded with a discount. Whatever the reason, each time this happens, it emboldens the police to make those dodgy arrests and the CPS to press those weak charges. And each time it happens, we see a mob of unthinking people baying for blood. Just being handcuffed, arrested, and detained for many hours is excessive punishment when you're innocent. Even where a defendant chooses to contest the weak charges, the odds on first instance acquittal are long. The lower courts have shown a remarkable deference to the mob, real or imagined. We are becoming accustomed to the notion that causing outrage is a crime. This will only get worse. In an inversion of Blackstone's ratio, Keir Starmer proposes to imperil 10 innocent people for the sake of capturing that one truly guilty person. This is precisely what the proportionality test is designed to prevent. If he can't see this, then I have absolutely no confidence in him or his public consultation. Keir Starmer, on behalf of right-thinking Britons, you have offended our sense of justice. I'm afraid it's time to go. You're nicked. This is Matt Flaherty for the Pod Delusion.
Now, the NHS is currently undergoing some surgery, courtesy of Jeremy Hunt, who's picked up the scalpel from Andrew Lansley and is proceeding to cut it open and offer the spoils to a number of private healthcare providers. Unfortunately for the NHS, Hunt isn't a doctor, so to avoid a trip for the NHS to Rose Cottage, a group of doctors are attempting to step in by forming their own political party, the National Health Action Party, which officially launched yesterday. To find out more about what the party are planning to do, we sent Trish Hand down to the launch to give us her prognosis.
I've joined a political party. It's not the first time, I admit, but at least this time I know that they won't be jumping into bed with the Tories at the first sign of power. I care deeply about the NHS, and I believe that socialised healthcare is too important for us to allow it to be destroyed by profiteers. Luckily, I'm not alone, and yesterday, Nye Bevan's birthday, a new political party was launched. The National Health Action Party was formed by healthcare professionals worried about the effect that the NHS reforms are having on patient care. Disgusted at the betrayal by the three main political parties, Dr. Clive Pidell and Dr. Richard Taylor decided to stand up and do something. Dr. Taylor is already well versed in politics. When the A&E department at his hospital was closed due to budget cuts, he stood as an independent candidate and defeated the incumbent Labour MP by no small margin. And early this year, Dr. Pidell ran 160 miles from Nye Bevan's statue in Cardiff to the Department of Health in Whitehall in protest of the Health and Social Care Bill. Clearly these men care. They founded the National Health Action Party with the following intentions: to base health and social care on fair, ethical principles and due process and governance. To decommercialise the health system with cooperation, not markets. To abolish the hugely expensive purchaser-provider split and wasteful competition. To increase the patients' and citizens' participation in the organisation and provision of healthcare. To reduce the influence of the costly management consultancy industry. To improve the integration of community and hospital care within the NHS, as well as between the NHS and social care. To promote innovative public health approaches to health improvement. And to reform the current unfair, overly complex and unsustainable social care system, and to promote a fair, effective and efficient health and social care programme integrated with sound public health and just economic policies. These are ideas I can get behind. So, having joined the party a while back and being not yet employed, I decided to show my support by attending a launch. A small group of us gathered outside Parliament yesterday morning while the fog still loomed over the city, and I recognised two faces instantly. One was astrophysicist and author Marcus Chown, a very vocal supporter of the NHS, as any of his Twitter followers will know. The other was living legend June Horto, the NHS campaigner who famously confronted the then Health Minister Andrew Lansley outside Downing Street in February this year.
Hello, I'm June Horto. I'm from Keep the NHS Public, been involved the last 6 years, and I'm from the local Southwest London group.
And can I ask, why did you confront Lansley that day?
Why did I confront Lansley? Because there was too many things going on behind closed doors, and the media's lips were sealed, and they were told not to broadcast, not to print, so I had to do something to get it in the public eye so the media could use it. And I will go on doing it. All the time they're going to go behind closed doors, which I told Lansley. He fell in the trap and he said, we're not privatised the NHS. And I said, Codswallop, don't you dare lie to me. You've been privatising it, or your party has been privatising it since 1979.
Absolutely. And do you have any plans to speak to Mr Hunt at all?
I'd love to speak to Mr Hunt, because I think they're so tied up in what they do, and not only they're stooges. I mean, but I don't know about Hunt, because he's more of a profiteering nasty man in my place. I mean, on my planet, health, people's misfortune, bad health, there should never be profit made out of it. Not only that, Nuremberg took 2 years to get it through Parliament, may have been a little bit more. Plus the fact that it doesn't belong to any government, it belongs to the people. And I still feel there's room for somewhere legal to give it back to the people where it belongs.
Absolutely. Thank you ever so much.
While I was chatting with June, the crowd grew, and when I turned around, the banner was up and there was a decent amount of both press and supporters. We all gathered for the photo call, sang happy birthday to Nye Bevan, and went inside for the press conference. As well as being the official launch, the press conference was also the ideal opportunity to announce the first five constituencies where the NHAP would field candidates. The seats they are challenging currently belong to David Cameron in Witney, Andrew Lansley in South Cambridgeshire, Jeremy Hunt in South West Surrey, George Osborne in Tatton, and David Laws in Yeovil. Most of these choices are fairly obvious. Cameron promised to cut the deficit, but his knife slipped and sliced through the NHS instead. Lansley stood beside him, opening up the NHS to private profiteers like a gleeful Igor. When he was ousted, a few of us naively thought that things could only improve. Oh no. Enter stage right, Jeremy Hunt. Even Tredinnick would have been preferable. George Osborne doesn't appear to understand basic economics and is ploughing ahead with dangerous austerity measures which are already ruining lives. And David Laws wrote that the NHS is a system that fails to allow for the disciplines of choice, diversity and competition which can help to ratchet up standards. So I'd say they're all fair game. The party doesn't want to split the vote, so seats are being carefully chosen to ensure that they don't stand against any candidate who shares the NHAP's goals. No actual candidates have been named yet, and these aren't the only seats which will be fought in 3 years' time, so expect further announcements in the coming months. If you're interested in joining the National Health Action Party, or if you just want to follow its progress, the website is nationalhealthaction.org.uk, and that's where you can find out about the party's policies and intentions. I would like to make it clear that this isn't a party solely for medics. Anyone who cares about public health issues and believes in the policies put forward by the NHAP can join, and if you live in an eligible constituency, you could even stand as a candidate. The NHS is here for everyone, rich or poor, old or young. Illness is indiscriminate. The NHS will be 65 next summer, and it's far too young to retire. This is Trish Han reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, you may remember that back in May, before the Eurovision Song Contest, we had a piece about how horrendous things are for human rights and free expression in Azerbaijan, which makes this next piece even more remarkable. Last week was the seventh meeting of the Internet Governance Forum, and it was held in Baku, the capital. Kate Russell was out there to do some proper journalism for some proper places. I think, the BBC, whoever they are. But whilst there, she met some kids from ChildNet who care about some of the issues that we constantly harp on about, such as freedom of expression online. So For young people, I guess it's not all Bieber and knife crime, and there might actually be some hope after all. And here's the remarkable thing. Despite recording this in Baku, I'm pretty sure that they all got back home with their kneecaps intact. Here's Kate Russell with more.
OK, so I'm here now with the ChildNet delegation, who I actually met for the first time last year at the IGF in Kenya, and they're here again. I'm just going to ask you, they're all 16 and 17-year-olds. I'm just going to ask you quickly to introduce yourselves.
Hello, I'm Nicola Douglas.
I'm Rebecca Cawthorn.
Jack Passmore.
And I'm Matthew Jackman.
Now, you guys are all here with ChildNet. Can somebody tell me first, how did you come to be here? What was the mechanism by which you arrived?
Well, personally, ChildNet came to my school and they ran a workshop for us and they asked us to present something to the class. I believe mine was should rich countries and poor country and fund poor countries to get online, and I presented this having prepared it for 5 minutes, and they said, you're quite good at public speaking, you're quite confident, and I think that, you know, we think that you'd be quite good in Kenya, so please do come along. And I was only too happy to say yes.
So is it similar for all of you?
It's a bit different to everyone else. I've been doing the IGF for 3 years now, and I work for a reporting company in Leeds, where I'm from, and they put me forward to attend the IGF with ChildNet, as they had made some connections with them. I think I was the only person who didn't get selected through a school, so that was a bit different. I had to make like a video and submit it to them so they could see that I could speak and quite fluently and publicly. So that was my way.
So you're here now, and you're sort of taking part in the discussions, but you're also having your own panel discussion tomorrow. Do you want to tell me what that panel's going to be on?
Yeah, well, it's Workshop 94, and it's really discussing young people, social media, and freedom of expression. Hopefully, during the workshop, we can try and identify what freedom of expression means to different people, and start to kind of move forward with in terms of educating young people, and then talking to service providers, and kind of getting a general sense for what these kind of three topics mean to all of us, and hopefully moving forward, you know, trying to define some lines where freedom of expression is, you know, how far can we express, what is right, what is wrong, and kind of use the youth's perspective to get a good gauge on that. So,
and what do you think are the important issues that we're going to be talking about in your tomorrow?
Well, I think anonymity is quite an important issue that I think we're all covering. Personally, I think it allows some people to sort of hide behind a mask and not really abuse the internet, but sort of go, some people can go too far with it. But I agree with what Nicola said earlier. She was talking about how it gives some people courage to be able to do things online that they wouldn't usually do if they weren't anonymous. So, and then there's other things such as we're talking to some delegates from Nordic Youth. And we'll be hearing some of their views on things like that. So it'll be quite interesting to see what they have to say.
What are the other issues that you think you'd like to discuss?
I think it's about the terms and conditions and clearing the line between what people can legally say online. I mean, a lot of young people don't read the terms and conditions. They don't have time for it. They find them too boring. There's many, many reasons that people don't read them. But that means that people aren't clear on what they can legally say on websites such as Twitter and Facebook. They don't know if they can send tweets to celebrities saying you smell or something like that. They don't know if they're actually legally allowed to say that. And I mean, that can make people get into trouble, such as the whole Tom Daley affair, which was a big thing in the news just at the time of the Olympics. And I think that for young people, that needs to be cleared up, so that they know what is classed as cyberbullying, what's classed as abusing celebrity, and what is within their freedom of expression rights.
I think also something quite important that maybe we may be discussing is that how social media can be used inside schools, because I personally, my section is interviewing educators, and I'm going to be asking them questions about what they've seen social media can be used for, and what experiences they've had of that. So I know, for example, in my school, social networks tend to be blocked during lessons to stop us being distracted, but we can use them to communicate with friends and family. In other schools, it's completely different. Becca's school, they're completely blocked all the time, whereas I believe in some of the schools in Denmark, they're using them for homework and things like that, and I think it'd be interesting to see the role of social media inside schools and what part that can play in our lives.
What kind of reaction do you get from the people that you meet at an event like this, you know, to your... Because you obviously come at these issues from a very fresh perspective. What kind of reactions are you getting?
Well, you know, you hope that people are listening to you, and, you know, the reaction is something of, you know, taking our ideas on board and kind of responding to them. I feel... Well, this is my second IGF, and I feel that hopefully this year I know what the IGF is about, so I can express my views in a more kind of clear way. I think last year I was, you know, quite vague in what I was saying, and people kind of reacted to me in the sense of, you know, he's not too sure why he's here. You know, he's saying things which are maybe, you know, quite useful, but they're not quite clear. So hopefully, you know, with clarity, because obviously, it's, you know, it's a multi-stakeholder event, that, you know, what we say can be listened to and can be kind of put into action as such. Yeah.
And we gave some input last year in Kenya into a workshop about youth delegates attending the IGF, and we had a great response from that after the workshop, which was really promising to hear. So hopefully, we're attending another one this year, so hopefully we can get good responses from our workshops.
Have you seen any youth delegates from other, I mean, you said the Nordic, is this been built on from the last session?
Yeah. When I came 3 years ago, there was only us, we were the only youth group who were attending the IGF. I think there wasn't even people from the host country, young people from the host country. So, I mean, it has grown lots. There's about 4 different youth groups here this year, and it's incredible to be walking around and seeing other young people rather than just people in suits. It's really nice to see that, and I mean, it's going to make such a varied perspective this year rather than just having, okay, here's an adult perspective and there's a few young people. It's going to be a very wide variety, and it's going to be great, I think.
Do any of you have any strong sort of desires about what you would like to take away from this, or you would like other people to take away from having met you?
Well, I suppose there's 2 things, really. Firstly, is that it's a multi-stakeholder discussion, and as it says on the IGF website, all opinions are valued, and this is how, although there's no direct action taken from any of the discussions here, by gaining more opinions, people can come away with a greater sense of what their particular organisation is working for, and, you know, who their clientele or the base of their customers is, depending on what they're doing, obviously. But also, something that I've been thinking about when I was preparing for the workshops is that we as youth are the policymakers of tomorrow. We're the people that in, you know, 10, 15 years' time are the people who are going to be controlling how the internet is progressing. And I'm here, you know, I'm getting information from people who have specific areas of expertise, and I'd quite like to see, you know, what they're doing with the internet now. So maybe if I decide to go into this area of policymaking, which is quite interesting, you know, I'm going to have some idea of what I'm doing, because I don't really want to mess it up.
Brilliant. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'd like to just kind of re-echo what Nicola just said there. I think, despite the fact that, you know, policies aren't written down here and here and now, I'd like to, you know, come away from here knowing that what I'd said has in some way, you know, changed the internet for better, because obviously the internet has grown to something so, you know, diverse and huge in a sense that it's kind of hard to control, hard to kind of tame in a sense. But hopefully if something I say has affected a positive change in the internet, that would make the whole experience worthwhile, I think.
Well, just that you can see where what you have said has made a slight impact. You talk to people at, like, when you're networking, they say, oh, I heard you say this. Well, we're making this policy. Do you think what you said could be relevant to it? Like, I was talking to Richard Allen from Facebook, and he was last year, and he was talking to me about something they were making about reporting, and I'd said something about that in one of the workshops, and he said, okay, we're thinking of doing this, and they made, he said, right, I like what you said, we're going to make a slight tweak to what we're doing. And I mean, I've noticed that, like, he said that to me, and I was like, okay, that's a really good idea, and giving feedback and stuff like that is just, it's amazing to think, okay, I've made a slight impact into something on the web. It's fantastic.
It's great, because, you know, we're digital natives, so, you know, we've grown up with the internet. I'm not saying we use it the most, but we use it for different things than maybe some of the adults that attend here do. So we can have that input and not teach them, but they can gain some knowledge from how we use it, and they can adapt their views and opinions on that basis. So.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, and you guys honestly speak the most sense out of everybody that I ever see at these events, so very good luck with your discussion tomorrow. I shall be attending and enjoying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, we've covered quite a lot of crowdfunded projects on this programme, but this week we've been speaking to a psychopharmacologist. I'm told that psycho is in psychological and not psychopathic, who is trying to raise money to do some basic scientific research. Ethan Perlstein wants to research the effects of methamphetamines, which I understand is currently the trendiest sort of drugs due to both the success of Breaking Bad and of Tory MPs admitting that they've taken cannabis and therefore making it totally lame by proxy. It's a fascinating project, especially as apparently we don't actually understand what these drugs can do. So to chat to Ethan, rather than meet him in a dank basement with just a mattress on the floor as you might expect, we instead met in the rather lovely surroundings of Conway Hall in London. I started by asking him exactly what he's trying to do.
So there's two parts to our experiment. There's the basic science component, which involves psychopharmacology, which is my expertise. And then there's a second part of the experiment, which is actually a sort of meta-science experiment, which involves doing science out in the open. And we think there are three components to this sort of open science approach. The first is a transparent open budget, so people can see how we spend their money. The second is data sharing in real time on the web, so people can monitor our progress. And the third component is proactive engagement on our part with other scientists and with the public at large, so they can understand in plain English what we're actually doing.
Hmm. You've chosen to look at methamphetamines for the actual science components, I guess. I mean, was that chosen to go with this experiment because meth is trendy? Because it's like guys do?
Yeah, so I was at Princeton for the last 5 years, my lab had been studying antidepressants. Mm. And when I was thinking about how to... So we were actually studying antidepressants with yeast cells, so with brewer's yeast, which is an unconventional model. And when we were thinking about how to parlay our results into a more conventional organism like a mouse, you know, which is on the way to eventually getting stuff into humans, we were thinking that maybe antidepressants were not the best way to go, because I think there's some controversy about them, and I don't think it's quite founded, but there's people out there who, for example, think that antidepressants don't do anything, that depression itself is sort of hyped up by the pharmaceutical industry, and it sort of lends itself to some bit of conspiracy theory. Not much, but there are people out there, I think, who are generally confused about it. So we wanted to pick some psychoactive drugs that were unequivocally active. People don't argue that meth is a placebo. People can see the effects. And also my collaborator at Columbia, David Sulzer, has been working on amphetamines in general since 1990. So it made for a good fit.
Mm. Well, I thought what was fascinating was I watched a little video on your appeal page, and you say we don't actually know what these drugs do to us.
Yeah, so I think over the last, I would say probably since the 1970s, when the recombinant DNA technology, the gene splicing technology, developed, it enabled scientists to focus really carefully on the effects of proteins in various biological contexts. And that was particularly true in pharmacology and psychopharmacology too. So there has been this school of thought that says, well, these drugs interact with certain receptors. Receptors are proteins. These receptors or transporters can interact with neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine. So there's ideas that psychoactive drugs are really, their effects really stem from these interactions with receptors and transporters. But there's this other school of thought that says that perhaps some of the pharmacological effects of these drugs don't necessarily reside in their interactions with these receptors, but perhaps have to do with the way that these drugs, for example, accumulate inside cells. And our work in yeast actually resonates with a lot of other literature going back decades that show that psychoactive drugs, not exclusively psychoactive drugs, but psychoactive drugs in particular, seem to accumulate in cell membrane, which is a lipid environment. And there are some consequences of that, we think, that have been either overlooked or simply not studied as much, because again, people have been, I hate to use the word obsessing, but I think to some extent people have been focusing to a large degree on this protein receptor interaction with drugs to the exclusion of these more physiological effects that might have to do with interacting with other cell components like the cell membrane.
Mm. It's really interesting as well that you're funding basic research. Why did you decide to fund it this way?
Yeah, so we knew that going into crowdfunding, the template is you have to provide some kind of a trinket or something. Mm. And so we thought, well, I suppose we could follow that form and, you know, make a T-shirt, but with some logo or something that reflected our project, or make something else. And we just sort of thought, well, we want most of our rewards to be experiential. And that said, we do offer at the $25 level, we offer a 3D printed methamphetamine molecule, just because 3D printing is hot. I think, you know, I always liked the aspect of chemistry where we had the chemical models. And I thought that might be a nice way to honor the tradition of providing some kind of a, you know, tangible thing, but have it be reflecting something specific about our project. But as I say, the other perks that we offer are more experiential, in the sense that we offer levels of engagement with us, the scientists, that are sort of, you know, commensurate with the degree of generosity. So at the highest end of the scale that we've set up, we offer the opportunity for people to actively participate in the manuscript writing process for any paper that would result from our research, so that whatever we publish is really accessible and in plain English. We also sort of have by default this data sharing and budget transparency, and I will be posting, you know, updates on my lab website. So that stuff is all sort of there, you know, by default. But we do offer, in the spirit of the reward system, these experiential perks that hopefully will draw people in and get people to really try out this engagement model.
Mm. In terms of people who have donated so far, I mean, what do you have any idea of, like, the demographic profile? Are these just members of the public? Are these scientists in similar fields who want to know what's going on?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So I'm kind of a data nerd, and on my website I've been posting weekly progress reports, and in there I like to dig into the numbers. And I know, you know, Nate Silver back home, we just had an election, so everyone now is in awe of the fact that math and stats actually, you know, work. So we were thinking we could sort of leave a digital paper trail of what's going on, and some interesting things pop out. In terms of our demographics, it turns out that the majority of our donors are actually men. It seems to be about 70-30. In terms of scientists, I can only make a judgment based on people that I know, and it seems among the people that I know, about only 20% of the donors are scientists. But then overall, if you ask the question, well, what percentage of people giving are strangers to me? And there's a slight majority, around 55%, that seem to be actually people that I don't even know. So these are people who have come to the site organically, been brought there through some of the media buzz that we've been lucky enough to have. So it's not just simply, you know, my best friends.
An interesting question about data, as I'm just reading Nate Silver's book now, he mentioned that Bayer ran an experiment that something like 2/3 of the data produced in some of these papers are not repeatable.
Yeah.
So are you hyper aware that you're going to have potentially 20% scientists or whoever crunching your data alongside you?
Yeah, I kind of, you know, I think that one of the things that one of the real major driving principles of this is that, you know, I've spent over a decade in training as a scientist in academic science. And unfortunately, I hate to say it, but I think the culture among academic science is one of sort of closed, of a closed process. And I hate to use the word secretive because I don't think it's that intentional. But I think inadvertently, most basic academic research in the States, at least, is sort of simply done behind closed doors. And even when an article is published, oftentimes, if you don't have an expensive subscription that comes, for example, if you're a member of a university, you don't really want to pay $35 to download a PDF for 24 hours. So, and even if you could, even if you wanted to pay $35 to download some random PDF of an article, you probably wouldn't understand it if you weren't an expert. And that's even talking about scientists, card-carrying, quote-unquote, scientists. If you're not in a certain field of expertise, it may be completely impenetrable given the jargon and just the way people tend to write things, I think, in a way that doesn't necessarily promote other people building off of the stuff. So I've seen those stats, and it's really disturbing to me that in the end, most research happening in at least in the States is funded by the taxpayer. And yet it seems like they're getting a raw deal because they either can't get access to the papers, the fruits of their taxpayer dollars. They can't understand it if they could. And even if they do get access to it, you know, a lot of the time it turns out that the experiments are flawed. So we challenge, and I open in a very sort of positive way, I challenge people to say, here, we're putting this stuff out there. We're not infallible. The whole point of the scientific process is if it's not reproducible, then that doesn't fit with the scientific method. So we want to sort of challenge people to say, look at our stuff, please notice us and let us know if there's something up. And if you can confirm our data, hey, do you want to collaborate? Let's do something. Let's keep building on this.
And on that lovely note, how can people get involved? How can people donate? How long do they have?
Sure. So we were lucky. We just got an extension. So we have until, I believe, November 25th. They can go to the website Rocket Hub. So just Google Rocket Hub or just go www.rockethub.com. Our project is called Crowdsourcing Discovery, and you should be able to find it just by searching that into the search bar on Rocket Hub, or just Googling my name and Crowdsourcing Discovery, or maybe even my name and meth. I don't know how Google search optimization has come along in the last couple weeks, but that should get you there.
Excellent. And we'll put links to find out all about that on the Pod Delusion website, and hopefully we could check in on something when the results of when the experiments are done and find out how it went.
That would be fantastic.
Excellent, Ethan. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
There's a longer version of this interview available on the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, as you'll know, last Sunday was Remembrance Sunday, but what you may not know is that whilst the ceremony at the Cenotaph is attended by representatives of all the major religions, there isn't actually anyone there representing non-religious people. So it turns out that last Sunday, whilst I was walking up to people with a broad smile on my face, wishing them a happy Remembrance Day, I was in fact not supposed to be allowed to do so. And why is this? And what can be done about it? To find out, I spoke to Chris Holden from the UK Armed Forces Humanist Association. I started by asking him about what the current situation is with regard to non-religious representation during remembrance ceremonies.
Well, there's actually more than one issue here, I think. I mean, to talk specifically for a moment about a remembrance ceremony, if I could just read first line from an order of service that came from Peterborough. The dean actually read out, this set the tone for the whole service. "We are here to worship Almighty God, whose purposes are good." That was obviously a local remembrance service, and that's one issue. There's humanist groups, including members of UCAFA, around the country who are trying to be included in local remembrance ceremonies. And that's one issue. And the other issue is that the national level at the Cenotaph and the sort of national expression of remembrance that we all know. What we're trying to do is to get a non-religious view included in this. I mean, just in terms of statistics, about 15% of the armed forces are non-religious. I'm not sure figures change, but apparently about a third of the population itself is non-religious or profess no particular god. You know, so, and beyond that, there's a third issue, I think, that encapsulates both and touches on broader areas. And that's the religious chokehold grip on ceremony and matters of the numinous that I've experienced myself serving in Afghanistan. So I think if we can challenge this and make sure that a non-religious rationalist viewpoint is heard at our remembrance ceremony, then we can start to have an impact on the other areas of ceremony in our lives.
So at the moment, just to make things clear for our audience, Remembrance Sunday and so on, you've obviously got the Archbishop of Canterbury or the, you know, representatives of Christianity and Islam and Sikhism there, but there's no non-religious despite the demographics, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's it entirely. And actually, obviously, you know, well, I take nothing away from the fact that they include all different faiths in the ceremony. That's fine, you know, because we're talking about inclusion rather than exclusion. But the point is that actually, a non-religious viewpoint makes up a larger percentage than, say, Sikh viewpoint. So it just seems a no-brainer to me that the non-religious view should be included in the ceremony.
So UKAFA have raised the issue with the government for a number of years now. I mean, what's the government's line be? Why have they said no humanists, no non-religious people?
Yeah, well, again, I think it goes back to the fact that there's more than one issue surrounding this. If we just talk about the national remembrance, as far as I can tell, the answer is that actually the structure of the remembrance ceremony was set a few years ago, and it would need a review which involved the royal household. And they're simply not prepared to do that at the moment because there's not enough political will to do that. UKAFA, backed by the BHA, has run a campaign in the lead up to this remembrance ceremony asking people to contact their MPs and put this forward in Parliament with mixed success, actually. But, you know, I predict that if more and more people do it, it's like any other political process in a democracy. If more and more people do it each year, then consensus will grow and Parliament won't be able to ignore it and we'll be able to do it. I mean, it's about fairness at the end of the day.
I wonder if it will be like before the royal wedding, everyone was like, we need to change it so just in case they have a girl, she can be queen ahead of any male offspring they have. And then everyone was like, oh, it was so difficult. But then they changed it and there was no trouble at all.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a cracking analogy, actually.
So on a more local level, you've got on your website, I see you've got some stories and anecdotes and testimonies from 2011 and the remembrance ceremonies then about how local people have tried to get involved in the remembrance services. Is it too early days? Have you heard anything about how 2012 went? Have any local humanists trying to do anything there yet?
Yes, we have. We've got a number of local humanist groups contacting us with stories of... On one hand, there's a couple of stories whereby they actually failed to become involved in the ceremony. But there's actually more coming back saying that they succeeded. And what we're going to do is when we launch our new website, hopefully this week, we'll send you a link. We're going to have these sort of anecdotes up there and perhaps create a resource for other groups to dip into and see how, on the one hand, inclusion was achieved, sort of what authorities contact, and on the other hand, how the manner of this inclusion panned out. Were they given speaking parts? Was there any poetry, humanist-type poetry, being able to read? What sort of inscription was put on flowers, that type of thing? So hopefully we'll get a resource going. And we've also got anecdotes from UCAFA members. Sadly, one at least who's passed away a couple of years ago. But we've got an anecdote of his experience as an atheist during World War II. Yeah, yeah, really interesting stuff. So this week we'll push out the link to that and perhaps get people to come and have a look.
I guess finally, I really want to ask you about your time in Afghanistan. I mean, you hinted at it earlier. How do ceremonies work over there? Is there similar sorts of issues in theatre?
The issues are identical, and this is why I think that there is a broader issue here. And I think those with an interest in maintaining the status quo understand this very well, and that's that maintaining a chokehold grip on ceremony and the numinous and all the rest of it is like the last bastion of religion, really, because they've been pushed out of all of the spheres of human interaction, rationality and all the rest of it. They know they've lost the battle there. So what they've done is they've entrenched themselves in these types of emotional ceremonies. And the same is true in Afghanistan. I mean, I take nothing away, though, from the chaplains who are out there, because they're extraordinarily brave people doing an extraordinarily unbelievable job. Because it's quite a profound experience over there, being part of a remembrance ceremony for comrades who have just died, particularly in that harsh environment. But I was staggered and impressed by the way that the chaplains did it over there, I must admit. Having said that, when you sort of glance around furtively, making sure the RSM doesn't notice you, looking at people without their heads bowed during the prayer, because these are religious ceremonies, you can see the look of bewilderment actually on some of the faces that, you know, there's enough religion out here without us bringing our own.
This is a really stupid basic question, I apologise, but are all these chaplains out in Afghanistan, I take it they're all Christian, or do you get other religions represented? Again, are the humanists left out, or is it everyone who's left out there?
Well, that goes on to a sort of a broader issue that UCAFA has been campaigning for quite a long time, and that's to get humanist chaplains, if you like. Although to me, and remember, herding cats comes up again. We're all squabbling and all different opinions and all the rest of it. The word humanist and chaplain to me is an oxymoron. But certainly in Afghanistan, I didn't notice anything other than Christian. I know there are humanist celebrants in a couple of garrisons in the UK, but certainly not in Afghanistan. And there's no funding for that type of thing in the MOD.
How can anyone listening get involved? It's writing to your MP, isn't it? That's what you want people to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, there was a formatted letter that obviously people can change to suit that was posted up on the Campaign for a 21st Century Remembrance website. That's done now, but there's a new one being put up there now that sort of is in context for following on from Remembrance and asking people to contact their MPs. So that definitely, I think, it, as ever in any democracy, that's the way to go. To get pressure building. And the other thing really is to join us at UCAFA or the BHA.
Excellent. And we'll put links to find out more about UCAFA and so on the Pod Delusion website. And we'll leave it there. Chris Holden, thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
Now, as you'll probably be aware, every day you remain alive on this wretched planet, you're only lurching closer towards death. But the world is getting closer to a gigantic energy crisis. There is a seemingly too good to be true solution, though. Fusion power. Unlike normal nuclear power, there's no risk of a meltdown, there's no waste that can't be disposed of for thousands of years, and you can't even turn it into a weapon. The only problem is that it's quite difficult to make it work. For decades now, scientists have been trying to figure out how to actually switch it on. Currently, it takes over 1% of the entire UK national grid to boot up Europe's largest fusion reactor for only 30 seconds. So, there's a bit of R&D to go yet. To explain more, though, here's Liz Luckendorf.
On Wednesday night, your intrepid editor, James O'Malley, and myself went to visit the Cullum Centre for Fusion Energy. Fusion energy, I hear you say. That's science fiction. Well, not really. At Cullum, they've been researching fusion energy for the last 30 years, with their fusion reactors, or tokamaks, mast, and jet. Even more exciting, Europe, Russia, Japan, and other countries are building an even bigger tokamak in the south of France, which they hope will prove that fusion energy really does work. After our tour, we had a few minutes to talk with Nick Balshaw, one of the engineers who works on JET, about the tokamaks and the future of fusion. I first asked him to explain what the MAST and JET experiments are.
Okay, MAST is a machine called a tokamak. It's actually a spherical tokamak, which is one of the two common types. And JET is also a tokamak, but it's a conventional-shaped tokamak. And MAST is the UK's fusion experiment, and JET is Europe's main fusion experiment.
On our first tour, where we went around MAST first, our guide talked about how before tokamaks, they had these linear fusion reactors. And what's the benefit, I guess? Okay.
So the benefit of a tokamak is that it's an endless magnetic bottle. So it's a ring, so it has no ends. And we create a magnetic field which controls the position of the hot plasma inside the machine. And plasma is the fourth state of matter. It's not solid, liquid, or gas. If you heat a gas to a very high temperature, you force the particles in the gas to lose their electrons. So you get the positively charged nucleus of every atom and the negatively charged electron. And charged particles follow magnetic fields, and that's why we can use magnetic fields to keep the plasma in the machine and keep it away from the cold walls of the machine.
And just for clarification for those of who don't know how hot this can get, what temperatures are we talking about inside a tokamak?
In JET, we can typically get to about 100 million degrees or so. So I actually claim a world record, because early in my career I worked on ultra-low temperature equipment, reaching 4 millikelvin, and now I work on JET, which gets to 100 megakelvin. I don't think many people can claim 11 orders of magnitude of temperature in one career.
The interest in fusion has been there for quite some time. How many reactors like this are in the world?
Well, in total, over 200 have been built, and there are probably about 40 operating at the moment. In fact, there's a database of all the machines that I've ever been able to find. That's a website, www.tokamak.info, and I've tried to collect important details of every machine that's ever been built. So if any of the listeners know of a machine that's not on my list, I'd love to hear about it.
Brilliant. And there's a new tokamak being built in France at the moment.
That's right.
In comparison, how big is that going to be compared to JET, say?
Well, JET itself's about 15 metres high. ITER will be twice as high, twice the diameter, so nearly 10 times the volume. And that's considered to be very important, because JET's not big enough to produce more energy than we get out. And one of the analogies I like to use is it's like a campfire. If you make a campfire the size of a golf ball, then you've got to be very careful adding fuel. It's very, very hard to keep it burning. Tennis ball size is a bit easier. Football size, you get a good raging fire going. Similarly, with a tokamak, we believe that going to bigger machines, we should be able to get more energy out than we put in. JET's around about break-even size. And the next time we run with the proper fusion fuel, deuterium and tritium, some people think we might get better than break-even. Some people think we won't. But this is all part of the uncertainty of an experiment like this.
What I found fascinating going from MAST and JET is the type of materials that you have to use to build it. So we had been to Diamond Light Source before, and we saw massive magnets and things like that, but the like beryllium and tungsten and graphite, and has it been trial and error over the last 30 years, say, from JET being built, or was there like sound reasons behind it to choose those in the first place?
Yes, there are good reasons. Mainly we like to have light materials around the plasma, because things like beryllium, beryllium's a very small atom, and if that gets into the plasma, it doesn't affect our experiments very much. So people have experimented with various materials over the years. Sometimes they go for materials like carbon, which is hard to damage, or beryllium, which is light and is thought to be relevant for ITER. In other areas and in other experiments, they've used materials which are very hard to melt, like molybdenum and tungsten. So in a sense, it's two different approaches to avoiding getting the stuff into the plasma, either something that you don't mind being in there or something that's hard to melt and get into the plasma.
And these aren't elements we really... Well, tungsten was in light bulbs and things like that. But beryllium, I can't think of something that's made of beryllium.
Beryllium is sometimes used... It's actually a very strong material and very light. So it looks like aluminium, but it's lighter than aluminium. It's actually used in some, for example, in military helicopters for the airframes. And the disadvantage with beryllium is it's a toxic material. It's actually only toxic to about one person in 20. I just don't know if you're one of them.
We got to go on the tour today because you're shut down for upgrades. And I think it was mentioned that you'd basically run for the time and then the equivalent time spent as upgrades. What are the upgrades that are going on right now, or what do you hope to upgrade to, I guess?
Okay, well, during the last shutdown, we replaced all the carbon tiles that face the plasma, and we replaced them with metal tiles. Some of them are beryllium, as you said. Some of the tiles have been marked with very thin layers of other metals, and we know how thick those layers are, or how thick they were at the beginning. We're now going to take about 50 tiles out and measure the thickness of that marker strip. And in some areas, we know that will have been eroded away. And in other areas, the material that's been eroded from somewhere else will be deposited. So that's actually quite an important thing to know about in a tokamak, because it's all to do with fuel retention. We want to have a wall that doesn't retain fuel. And that means fuel that you put in that doesn't get burnt can be taken back out and recycled. But if it's locked up in the tiles facing the walls, then you can never burn it. So low fuel retention materials are it's part of the holy grail of fusion.
Cool. And I guess to explain what exactly goes on here, what are the type of experiments that you run?
Well, one example of an experiment we ran before the last shutdown, when we still had a carbon wall, we ran a whole day of the same pulse repeated time and time again. So the machine runs for about 30 seconds at a time, and then we have to wait for everything to cool down. So we ran it 20 or 30 times, and we measured how much gas we put into the machine. And then at the end of the day, we recovered all the gas from the machine, and the difference between what we put in and what we got out again at the end is still locked up in the wall. So we ran the same experiment again with the new wall, and made the same measurement, and we found that the fuel retention is much lower with the new metal wall, as we hoped.
Cool. And I guess my final question is, there was the joke at the beginning when we sat down for our health and safety that fusion energy is always 30 years off.
Yeah.
What are the hopes for like ITER and fusion reactor in like 10 to 20 years? Are we going to see some things put on the grid, or is commercial still at that end scope of 30 years?
Well, as you say, the industry joke is fusion's 30 years away, and it always has been. But now we're finally building a machine that's big enough to produce net energy. And when ITER's running successfully and producing 500 megawatts, at that stage, I think you could expect the big power companies or, you know, energy companies to start to take fusion very seriously. At the moment, it's too far away for them to have it, for their accountants to be interested, really. And so they don't want to be involved in the early stages until they're convinced that there's a good chance of it working.
Is ITER going to have the capacity to go on, to put back onto the grid?
So ITER will never produce power for the grid, right, but it'll be the right size for a machine that will.
Cool.
And the machine after ITER, there are various plans for a demonstration power plant after ITER. And the design work for that's already started, and some of that's happening here at Cullum.
Very exciting. James, do you have any?
Yeah, given that it runs for... This may be a complete misinterpretation of the thing, and I apologise if so, but given that the pulses only last for 30 seconds at the moment, will a working fusion reactor that powers things be on constantly? Is that how the technology will develop?
We don't know for certain whether it'll be absolutely constant or whether it'll be very long pulses.
Mm.
So there are different concepts at the moment. Jet only runs for about 30 seconds at a time, but other machines have run for much longer. And in fact, the world record is held by a Japanese machine called Tri-M, or Tri-M 1M, which has run for 5.25 hours continuously. I think it's true to say that all the big machines around the world can do something that none of the others can do. And the aim with ITER is to bring the benefits of all the big machines together into one device.
You can find more about Colm and the Tokamak's mast and jet by following the links on the Pod Delusion website. This has been Liz Luchtendorf for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, you may remember on last week's show, we featured some amusing Twitter reactions from Republicans following the American election. But if America is the golden goose that keeps shitting out amusing crackpots, the election has surely been a bout of explosive diarrhea, as many of the right-wing pundits have struggled to come to terms with the fact that Obama won. In fact, we've exclusively unearthed a recording of Nixon talking about the results. I mean, friend of the show, Blakely Nixon. I don't know who you were thinking of. Here's Blakely with more.
Last week, President Barack Obama secured a second term as US president. It was a close election, though Obama's lead was far more comfortable than many had predicted, with the notable exception of Nate Silver. The reaction around the world from many of my fellow liberals was far removed from the jubilation displayed after Obama's 2008 election. Our response was more akin to the quiet sigh of relief of a man who has just been told the operation to remove his testicle has in fact stopped the cancer. Yes, you are going to live, but you still only have one testicle. Yes, we have saved the world from 4 to 8 years of a Tea Party-influenced Republican administration, but we still have to deal with reality, an anemic economy, a Middle East in flames, and a US political system so entrenched and cynical that hope and change have simply become concession and compromise. But hey, the good guy, well, the less evil guy has won. Furthermore, gay marriage has passed in 4 states, whilst pot was legalized in 2. Something that, in my mind, makes a large and ever-growing swathe of America far more progressive and reasonable than we here in the UK. And though our friends in liberal America are no longer able to look forward to the bright future in the once-promised Obamatopia, we can at least join them and take pleasure in the reaction of our friends and brothers on the right of the political spectrum. People on Fox News, the extreme right blogosphere, and various comment sections of the internet seem to be going through their own version of the 5 stages of grief. This is the 5 stages of right-wing post-election grief: denial, anger, conspiracy theories, secession, and general batshit craziness.
Denial.
Before the polls had even opened on election day, many pundits on the right had already called the election for Romney. The denial stage started on election night. Many of you would have seen Karl Rove's astonishing breakdown on Fox News after being told by the Fox News decision desk that Obama was about to win Ohio and in turn the presidency. If you haven't seen it yet, you should. I will make sure James puts a link on the Pod Delusion website. And I certainly cannot add more analysis than Jon Stewart did on The Daily Show immediately after the election.
Anger.
So once the election results were in and it became clear that Obama had won, the anger phase set in. This also began on election night. Right-wing super pundit Bill O'Reilly roared,
"It's not a traditional America anymore, and there are 50% of the voting public who want stuff. They want things. And who is going to give them things? President Obama."
And continued,
"The white establishment is now the minority."
Post-election, a teary-eyed Glenn Beck reminded us that,
"God is stalking us."
And lamented the fact that half of all America was
utterly and completely lost in darkness. Conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy theories, which are essentially a return to denial, are numerous and aplenty. Birtherism still lingers on the fringes of American political society like a bad smell, and will probably continue to do so for the foreseeable future. Before the election, Alex Jones, radio host, conspiracy theorist, and a man whose voice sounds like gravel in a blender, claimed that the powers that be created Tropical Storm Sandy as a rather extreme way of assuring the election for Obama. Jones claimed,
"They can send an aircraft to steer it. Kinda like how you herd cows."
Post-election, a small number of right-wing analysts began to focus on voter fraud. Voter fraud became an issue before the election when many Republican legislatures attempted to introduce voter ID. Many on the left claimed that this was a cynical attempt to disenfranchise poorer voters. After the election, screams of voter fraud became louder. One of these cries came from Joseph Farah from the right-wing website and smearer of bullshit, WorldNet Daily.
"Am I suggesting that the recent presidential election was stolen through voter fraud and manipulation? Without a doubt. Do I have evidence? Yes. I have plenty of anecdotal evidence to show that it was committed by one side of the election in various ways."
One of the claims that began to emerge on Twitter was that the votes counted in a county in Florida, St. Lucie, equaled 141%. Until the county explained that it wasn't the number of votes that were counted, it was the number of cards counted, with each voter receiving two cards to vote with. Other claims began to emerge from Philadelphia, where a number of precincts recorded 100% of their vote for Obama. With Fox News' Sean Hannity claiming that this was
mathematically impossible.
This ignores the fact that a similar number of counties went 100% for Obama in 2008. It also ignores the fact that a number of counties across the country went 100% for Romney. Other claims are emerging, and I'm guessing Right Wing Radio and Fox News will be using the words voter fraud for the foreseeable future.
Succession.
That's right, a small number of America-loving Americans on the American right, who love American democracy, have decided they don't like the findings of an American democratic election and have therefore decided to leave America. Now, this was touted on a number of right-wing websites as
states petition for succession.
In reality, what this means is that a number of individuals in all 50 states have started petitions on the White House's We the People petition website calling for the peaceful secession of each individual state. As I've been recording this, the petition for Texas has just crossed 100,000 votes. The threshold for a response from the White House is 25,000, and states like Arkansas, Georgia, and Louisiana crossed that a while ago. All in all, around 700,000 people have signed these non-binding petitions. The Texas petition reads,
given that the state of Texas maintains a balanced budget and is the 15th largest economy in the world, it is practically feasible for Texas to withdraw from the Union, and to do so would protect its citizens' standards of living and re-secure their rights and liberties.
There is also a picture of a protest happening in America where the banner reads,
Sec Day.
Could it be that the Union is doomed?
Batshit craziness.
I'm an optimist, and I would like to think that the final stage for the five stages of Republican post-election grief would be acceptance. And there are signs that this could possibly happen. Republicans like Newt Gingrich have made statements that suggest that they are going to look at the Republican Party and reflect on the reasons they've lost. Other right-wingers have even been talking about reassessing the party platform with regards to gay rights, gay marriage, abortion, and others have even been discussing negotiating with the president on the Bush tax cuts. But let's face it, there's a very, very good chance that the right-wing will just degrade into batshit craziness. Much like birtherism and climate change denial, much of the things discussed in this segment, such as secessionism and the false claim of voter fraud, might actually become mainstream within the Republican Party. Or at least something you can't dismiss without losing votes in certain congressional districts. But that degradation to complete batshit craziness might not even be a bad thing for the US and the wider world. If the right wing, at least the extreme right wing, begin to focus on such extreme ideology, this will, as the election has shown, turn off a sizable portion of American voters, making this ideology completely unelectable in the future. Here's hoping. This is Blakely Nixon for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Before we go, do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3 years of archives or an extended version of the interview with Ethan Perlstein. Also on our website, you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, if you're into those sorts of things. Or, of course, if you have enjoyed this show, then please do subscribe and donate. Our hosting costs for the actual episodes of The Pod Delusion have doubled in the past couple of months, so all donations are hugely appreciated. So please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Matt Flaherty, Trish Han, Kate Russell, Liz Luckendorf, Blakely Nixon, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The inserts into Blakely's piece were by the amazing Mark Silk, the voice of Johnny Bravo. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Evening, Dave. So, who did you vote for in the Police Crime Commissioner elections, then?
Brian, I like the lady that favoured rehabilitation. The UKIP fella that wanted to bring back the Birch, he didn't appeal. And the Lib Dem candidate made all the right promises, so obviously he'd have done the exact opposite if he'd gone in. Who did you go for?
Well, looking at all the options, I've put me cross against Jimmy the Fingers McGraw.
Jimmy the Fingers? The most villainous scumbag in the area? He wasn't even on the form.
Yeah, it wasn't this morning, yeah. But he'll be on the winning papers in time for the count if Operation Ballot Swap goes to plan.
I see. So you reckon he'll get in then?
I'm confident. It'll be a comfortable win. 6 million votes. I saw the invoice.
6 million? There's only 2 million people in the district.
Well, Mickey the Print had a special offer on bulk jobs and had a lot of paper spare when the banks decided not to print more notes for quantitative easing.
Look, imagine if the biggest tow rag around got the PCC gig. Scallywags like us two would have the easiest ride going. Legalising burglary, mugging. Every day would be Christmas.
Yeah, I know. I've bought a new stripy jumper and a crowbar in anticipation, mate.
Mr. Two.
Yeah?
Mr. Brian Damage Two.
Could be.
Commissioner Fingers McGraw is not very happy with you. We hear you've been littering the streets. To wit, a receipt from Primark for a stripy sweater.
It's only littering. I'll pick it up.
Too late, Mr. Two. You've been a naughty boy on Fingers Manor. It's a concrete overcoat for you.
Seems a bit harsh.
You voted for him, and 5,999,999 others can't be wrong.
Do you know, I don't mind the irony. It's just a shame the concrete's going to ruin my new jumper.